Call the meeting of the, now that Representative Olin entered the room, we'll call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Finance Division to order. And, do we have a quorum yet or not? One short. All right. We'll just, what we're going to do is move into our first house file. Well, first of all, just some housekeeping things. Again, I think I shut off my cell phone, but shut off your cell phones. Again, we had our first incident last committee hearing. It was our sergeant of arms in the back whose cell phone went off, and he consequently did bring the money for the can, and it's in the jar. So $1 if your cell phone goes off, $5 if you answer it. And that was kind of in dispute, too, but he claims he was out in the hall by the time he answered it. So, all right. So we only charged him $1, and he paid up and felt sheepish that he was the culprit. So, and there is okay. There is coffee up there for anyone in the audience that wants it. And let's see. First thing we're going to do is Representative Anderson. Reviewed the minutes of March 11th and moves their approval. Is there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? They are approved. Secondly, members, I talked to Representative Magnus and Hamilton. We're required by today just to send a memo out, our committee, to bonding. In your file, you have a copy of that memo. Basically, what we decided to do, all these projects have been approved the last couple of years that we're sending to them, and we're not funded fully. And so all we're doing is sending on projects that have already had approval. We're going to hear all the other bonding bills in this committee after May 1st. Hopefully there's a report due at the department on areas of need in the state for homes and other things. Once we get that report, then we'll hear all the bills for next year's bonding bill, the new projects that we'll be recommending on. So this is just simply a memo. It's actually got military affairs in there. You'll see also they asked us to do the military affairs, which in all likelihood we'll end up with in the long run anyway for bonding projects too. So we just simply are sending on what did not get funded the last few years but was approved by the department. So that's, I just want to make note of that. That's in your file folder if anyone has a question. But that'll be transmitted to a bonding committee this afternoon. I need to give the presentation. With that, Representative Olin, come on down. Representative Olin has got House File 309. Representative Doty moves House File 309 for consideration in our omnibus. Bill, I know Representative Olin, I think you had some people down today, so we're accommodating you here. First up to talk about the elk bill, and we'll go from there. So it's your show, Representative Olin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And by way of information, I also have a DE1 amendment that you all should have got, I hope.
Okay. Oh. Okay, Representative Doty also moves a DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that Representative Olin would like to see it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Olin, it's in the shape you asked for.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'm going to say here will be pretty brief for the moment. I do have a PowerPoint that Quinn will quickly go through. With numbers anyway, which will show you where we're at.
Olin, are these your donuts?
I believe that I'll end, yeah.
We were
Mr. Cummings so far said they showed up, so.
We were kind of wondering if you would even show up. Now that you have these, we didn't know if it was necessary.
Evidently in L.A. Decided we should have those.
And I will point out
there
are
of his Wilmer,
there
former
are some
well.
Pastries here with green frosting and green shamrocks on them, even though I don't see a lick of green on you, so I just want to point that out, too, for the record.
I did kind of blunt.
And some of you other people, too, by the way, who had no notion this morning that it was St. Patrick's Day, apparently. Huh? Your eyes are green? Okay. Very good. Everyone's Irish today. All right, go ahead.
Okay, what's been happening in the elk deprivation and wolf depredation is, for years, and I sponsored the governor's bill 2 years ago, basically, in 2007. At that time, we had 100,000 in each account. and for years that had been enough. In fact, I think the highest might have been 83,000 if I remember, rounded off. Well, what's happened, we now have a far greater amount of elk up in northwest Minnesota than we had before. We started with a bigger herd of elk, which probably at originally maybe only was 30, which is now closer to 70 or to 75, and we have added a Lancaster, Kitson County herd of elk, well, herds of elk, I should say, because there's different groups of them there, which each group's probably anywhere from 30 to 40, plus the group from that's up on the Canadian border that keeps going back and forth, so we don't know exactly what the number is. And a few more, I've heard rumor, have went further south in Kitson County down towards Lancaster. Lake Bronson, which is getting almost to the southern part of Kitson County, which creates a real concern. If they start migrating any further, they're going to hit Marshall County and they're not very far from Sugar Beet Country, and then we will really have a problem. So basically what I've done is I've increased the... We've already got $112,000 worth of claims in fiscal year 08. In 09 fiscal year, we're already over the numbers. So what I've requested is $50,000 more for 09, which actually probably, as the governor's office just pointed out to me a while ago, probably needs to be in a deficiency bill if we ever had one. But I've raised the numbers to $250,000 in each of 2010 and 2011. The governor actually has raised his, knowing there is a problem, to $150,000. So I'm basically $100,000 higher than the governor's numbers. The real concern in the whole area is, you just heard my elk numbers, but I think the people in this room that are, some of them in Kitson County who also have wolf floating around can testify that the wolf numbers are raised, but some of you other legislators are well aware of the wolf problems in other parts of the state, which have also increased. So their depredation dollars are badly needed in higher numbers. And that's essentially what I have to say. If there's any questions, I have support staff. I have Quinn Cheney here, and I also have Kitson and Marshall County representatives, actual delegates, if you would like to hear from them.
Two questions from me. Number one, can you tell the committee a little bit about the damage that occurs? I mean, are they laying in the fields? Are they tromping the fields? Are they eating the crop? At what stage is the damage occurring? Looking for someone to come down and tell us a little bit about it.
I'm going to call on Joel Alepsky, because not only has he got probably the better pictures that he could pass around a little, he also has testimony he can give on it. So I'll let...
And did you bring... These are your pictures here in the file folder, too?
Yeah.
And the map?
Maybe. Right, and he can explain those better, because it's a lot, mostly Kitson County pictures.
All right. Welcome to the committee. We just asked that you introduce yourself, because this is all on tape, and so the tape can't see you. So tell us your name, and then let us know, if you could, some of the damage it's caused and what it looks like.
Okay, my name is Joel Olebsky.
Spell that last name for me.
W-I-L-E-B-S-K-I.
Okay.
Not Irish.
Not Irish. Today you are. Everyone's Irish today.
Amen, amen.
My Irish wife tells me. All right.
Thank you for having us or letting us come here. 410 miles from me. I give you an idea where I live. I live a mile from the Canadian border and about 20 miles from the North Dakota border. I'm closer to Winnipeg, Manitoba than I am to Thief River Falls. I 2 years ago, I was blessed with a timber wolf problem. I come up 26 calves short. I got proof of 8. I had 3 federal trappers out. We hauled in 7 deer. I did, and the federal trapper, the second one, hauled in 2. They cleaned them up. They got 2. They come back and did a little bit of help the next spring. I went to school, Grand Rapids, to try to help my own self out, and I got rid of 3. So it's helped, but now they put them back on the endangered list, and this last past week now, within my building site, within 2 miles, four of them come through. So I've been down to about 4 or 5 meetings in the last year, and I guess one thing I'd like to stress to you people, all the problems I have with timber wolves and with elk are less than 2 miles from my house where we live. It's not, you know, way off in the boondocks. And as far as the damage, well, the calves, you know, that part, the crops, they'll eat the crops, they'll waste, they'll crawl on top of hay bales if you got them, they'll take, once they crap and pee on them, cows won't, they won't eat them, and of course you can't blame them for that. And then out in the field, they probably waste more, tramp more down than they eat, but they love corn, soybeans, oats, wheat, and if you got bulls, and I've had them where in the summertime where after they swath, they get in there, and I guess if any of you grew up in a farm where bulls, they, you know, they bust off and stuff, gets a little high, they start to, you know, just wrecking things just for the pure sake of, you know, showing off. They'll do that. So the damage is more than just the eating. It's just the traffic. I had winter wheat the 1 year, and in the spring of the year when the ground's soft, they come out there, and when they went back and forth off the field, they tramp, they root up the field, so they wreck the crop when it's coming up. And now last year I got a picture, and maybe see it, there's 19 on one snapshot, there's 25. My wife only got 19. They're coming out when the alfalfa's coming off of dormancy, and there's some people in some organizations that said that don't hurt the crop. Well, if it doesn't, I guess I'll just, I can pasture my cattle out there if it doesn't hurt it. I mean, there's got to be a lot of education, there's got to be a lot of communication, and last of all, we got to have management. I guess I could sit here all day and tell you my problems, but I guess if there's something that I could answer that you don't understand or I didn't make clear, I'd sure be willing to visit with any of you, or even after the meeting, if somebody wants to call me or visit me, I'm available. Good, bad, or ugly, it doesn't matter. I'm willing to talk to anybody.
All right, very good. We appreciate that. Any questions, members? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me swallow my donut.
Yeah, that's fine.
Mr. Walewski, does anything like a cannon, like you'd use to scare away blackbirds or anything, would that have any effect on these elk?
Mr. Walewski.
Matter of fact, I had a cornfield here 2 years ago. I called up the warden, and he called over to the wildlife office. They brought out 2 cannons. I got a furnace of propane. That's fine. One cannon didn't work, so I hooked up the other one. I got one working. And I had bales, saw bales right next to my cornfield. And I set the cannon on the second night. They come back within 100 yards of the cannon, and the bull did, and he just tore one saw bale all to pieces. And the cannon was working, I mean, within 100 yards. So then I took the cannons back to Carlstead, and I told them what happened, and their response was, they didn't work as good on the animals, they work better on birds. So if they knew that, I guess that kind of frustrated me too.
Okay. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I don't know how these elk are in relationship to deer, but in the cornfields, do they go along when the corn's about 3 foot tall and pull out the tassel, you know, when the top in there where the, and just pull that out and just for something to do, keep going down the road, just to play with it, or and take a bite and go to the next one? Or how do they do the damage in the corn? Or do they actually chip the field?
You brought up another interesting thing. There is a bird that comes around and picks the corn out when it's about this tall, and it eats the kernel after it's germed and doesn't eat the rest of it. That's a Samuel crane. But as far as the corn, the trouble I've had in the corn is after it matures, and they'll eat the ear. They'll be like a deer, they'll snip off the ear. But if you get some bulls in there, when they're getting their own frisky in the fall, what they come in, they just, what I think they do, because the corn will end up about this tall, and it's all, everything above is just shredded, So I think they're just doing it to show off and whatever, but they actually waste damage more than they eat, but they'll go along, they just eat the cream of the crop. They just take the ears that are good to eat that.
Okay, thanks. Representative Fowler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these elk, are they always in Minnesota? Do they go back to Canada? They go back and forth? Or, I mean, what's their pattern and how big an area do they usually travel in?
Up in Kitson County, there's actually three herds. And I got a map here. I thought you had that, but maybe not, that the DNR put out. And it's pretty accurate. It's not real accurate because the Watertower herd and the Lancaster herd or the tame herd do not commingle. And they got it in there where they crossed it. And they really don't, but that doesn't matter. They don't. They stay there. They winter more in my area, like that. I'm speaking of the Watertower herd. And then in the summer, they'll go back west and they'll have their calves cross 59. They get into more agriculture area. Where I'm at, it's more wasteland and stuff. It's more cattle country. I raise some soybeans and corn and alfalfa and wheat and stuff, oats. But they're getting over there, and that's where some of the big claims that have come in now, like hit the $20,000 max. But in my area, it's less because they've been chased out. And my theory is that elk aren't a stupid animal. I mean, nature, they have the ways of telling each other. There's a lot of wolves in my area, and you go about 3 miles to 4 miles west of me, you kind of get out of the wolf area. And I think that's what's happening. And the DNR put in a 40-acre wildlife plot on their land. They had a beautiful crop of corn. And even the Deer Hunter Association guy up there, he can't understand why there aren't more deer and elk, and they've been in there, but they leave. And they shouldn't leave when you got, they had a wonderful crop. I got to give them credit for that. And they looked at me, and I said, well, think of it. The only enemy they got is the wolves. We can't shoot them. That's the only enemy they got. That's where they move out. And then they come on private land. You can't blame them for that. And as far as the herd that goes into Canada, that's about 6-7 miles east of me, and they go into the Bita Arbaca area. They go back and forth from Lancaster or Kitson County into Manitoba, and they have problems up there. And their biggest problem, they got a lot of dairy in that area up in Canada, and the government up there, whatever, they do a lot of fencing of their feed piles in there. But
Representative Olin.
Yeah, I'll just make one comment quick. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, Representative Faust, you have two herds that are domesticated that stay in Kitson County year-round. And then you have that Canadian group that's flying all over, that's going between the border. But two of them don't ever really go into Canada.
Okay.
Right, that's right.
Representative Andrews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You touched on the hunting part of it. What do you have up there as far as hunting regulations, and do you ever get permission to take any elk if they're causing severe damage?
Yep.
Last year, we come down in June, and we had a real good meeting with DNR and Board of Animal Health, and Joe Martin was there. They had 11 life were given out in Kitts County, 10 cows, one bull, 100% successful, and they're handing out, I don't know the exact number, but I'm guessing probably it's getting close to 12 to 15 that have been shot by farmers. And I'm against that personally, and I'm a farmer, and you're going to look at me and say, wow, what's wrong with you? Well, first of all, the farmers had to do it. They shot it. They had to take it into locks plant, see if they could shoot, and they shoot it, take it into locks plant. Then I know the neighbors, then they have to wait and take the waste back, and the locker plant to process it, then the DNR comes and takes and gives it to a food shelf. And the farmer doesn't get a taste of the meat. And I'm against that because we got DNR sitting back to Mr. Bogus. He could probably tell you how many licenses were put in for this last summer. I've heard 4,000 or 5,000, whatever. And to me, it seems like such a waste. If there's that many people that put in and wanted the license, we could have made another 15, 20, 30 people in Minnesota tickled pink that could have shot an elk. And
And anybody in the, I only know one farmer that got, and he doesn't live in our area, that wanted to charge for a hunt, but all the hunters that come to my place, I told them they shoot elk on my land, they'll load it for nothing.
All right, very good. Is there other testifiers? Joe Martin, were you going to say anything? Representative Hamilton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. What percentage of those elk that cross the Canadian border get tested every time by the DNR or the Department of Health or anything like that, every time they cross the border? I'm just kidding. I don't expect an answer to that because I know what it is. You know, it's unlike if you receive cattle from, you know, Canada or whatever, the process that goes through. Anyway, the question that I have is the percentage that of the damage that takes place on your farm, what percentage of that is covered by these grants? Does it come close to reimbursing you the losses?
No. I don't want to get rid of all elk, and I don't want to get rid of all the timber wolf. I live with them. I'm a third-generation farmer, and I'm afraid it's glass. I got two sons, and they see the garbage I got to put up with. So I really can't blame them. But I don't want to get rid of all the wildlife. I've lived there. I've grown up with them. You know, I don't mind seeing them. But I tell you what, when they start, like when I lost all them calves and only got paid for 8 out of the, you know, out of the 26 that come up short with because, you know, you found the bones and whatever. And you know, I asked the people that I'm dealing with, I said, you know, when you go to the grocery store, that dollar that you buy the loaf of bread, does that cost you the same as it cost me? I said, well, you think it's all my profit, and you set me back a year. You know, the management is so disgusting. It's so disgusting that it just frustrates you to the bitter end. And now, like last year after we had that meeting, every time I fixed fence after the spring fix, this is just what they, in the summertime, I kept track every time I fixed fence because of the elk. I just kept track of stuff that I wasn't compensated for any of that. And for years, I bet you over all the years, I probably got $1,000 in claims for the elk damage. I didn't turn in a damage for my crop last year. They were in there. But I guess the way the management is now, and I don't want to badmouth the DNR. I mean, they've heard this, the same song and dance, but it's getting awful old. From now on, I'm going to keep track of everything I can. And I guess I'm just going to put in a bill, whether I get paid or not. I guess I'm going to do it for the documentation, and maybe someday they'll realize that, you know, we got a problem, and maybe we got to work with these people a bit better. That's what we need, communication, and we got to have management.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to comment. I know one case up there that had 20-some thousand that hasn't gotten paid a dime. And that's what I'm referring to is that extra 50 grand that I badly need in last year. And the other thing that I do know, Mr. Oletsky is probably one of the true examples of a guy that hasn't put in for the dollars that he has had coming over the years.
Sure.
And one thing I'm going to add, that there's been some elk management references, and I just want you all to know that yesterday I was at Game and Fish, and I did add a part to the Omnibus Game and Fish bill that will put pressure on the DNR to get the elk management plan into the place and operating. And Mr. Bogus was there, and he did not, and he's content with that bill. They know they got to do that.
Okay. All right. Well, very good. We appreciate you coming. We appreciate the testimony. And what we're going to do is lay this over, and then we'll continue to have conversations with Representative Olin, who's got a very good bill here, and the department to try and discover exactly how much we need to put in that fund. But certainly, I suspect this committee will want to put whatever it takes in there to make sure that you get compensated and your neighbors get taken care of. So we appreciate you coming down.
Thank you very much. I probably just echo a little bit on that. I know that there's farmers that have never put in a claim, and they're getting frustrated, and they're going to do it. So I think, unless something really changes, I think it's going to just be a wall-type deal when it comes to, you know, I suspect, and maybe not, but... And if finally, thank you all. I appreciate the chance you give me. I never did this before, so if I lost up your time or whatever, but I'm sincere on this. If anybody ever got any questions or wants to talk or come up,
come up north. We'll give you a tour, explain stuff one-on-one, and we'll be as great as host you ever see.
On your way to Winnipeg, anyone can stop in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time. And as you can see, I called on Joe Walewski because I knew he would be the one that could answer
questions. Yeah, one more quick question from Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your testimony, and you mentioned that you'd like to see some elk left up in the area. So whatever the number is now, what number would be workable? Half, a fourth? What would you like to see in terms of the numbers up there?
That's a very good question. Representative Owens, he proposed 30. And I guess what scares me about that is, I know through the years with the DNR, their count is a lot different than if somebody else goes up and flies and counts. So I guess I'm worried about the count and the area. See, because they're a herd animal. I mean, they get in a rut, and like in the spring of the year, they'll probably come out on my meadow and stuff, the whole herd, and just stay there for probably 2-3 weeks, and then they'll split off. And I've been fortunate. They've only left behind like one or two other years. Well, last year they left behind 9, and then the big herd went. Well, they're splitting up, so you're getting more and more. Well, if you ever get where they, you know, I don't know how they can manage it. I mean, it's going to be a task. How you can manage it to get, so you just say you have 7-8 in that area, 7-8 in that area, 7-8 in that area. That's going to be a task. I don't know how they're going to do it. But there was one herd by Lancaster. I believe they got eliminated because that's the one that's coming right into yards. They're laying. They're not scared of vehicles and stuff. But, I mean, it's going to be a task, but I think they got to realize they got to have input from the people up there and work with the people. And maybe together we can come up with something. It's not going to be simple. I understand that.
All right. Thank Representative you. Anderson, just for the record, there's 30 in the Kitson County group and 30 in the Marshall County group is what I proposed. I didn't call on a Marshall County representative, but they could say basically the same other narratives. Their numbers are way off. DNR says 53, and they know they're 75 or something.
All right, House File 309 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, we got about 20 minutes for each of the three presentations before us. Board of Animal Health, then we're going to hear dairy and food, and then we're going to hear the laboratories. I think we can get through that, no problem. So we'll start with Board of Animal Health. Let's see, we have Ms. Cheney there. Do we have a Paul Anderson, too? Oh, yeah, there he is. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself. Tell us where you're at in the budget book, et cetera, et cetera. I assume it's just the one section is all you, right? So there's a tab for Board of Animal Health. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Anderson. I'm a veterinarian, and I'm an assistant director with the Board of Animal Health, and I've been asked to present our proposed budget for this next biennium.
Okay, proceed.
Mr. Chairman, just to give you a little background on the Board of Animal Health, the Board of Animal Health was established in 1903. There's two pictures on your slide on the monitor. Our very first state veterinarian is the gentleman in the black and white picture in the back row on the very far right. That was Dr. Ward. He served until he died of avian influenza influenza, whether it was swine or avian, it was one of the two, died in 1918 of that disease. The picture on the bottom, the color picture, is our current board, board members. Paul Fitzsimmons from left, on the left in the blue shirt, is a swine producer. Steve Brake, next in line, is a cattle and hog producer. Mahesh Kumar is a poultry producer and a veterinarian. We have two veterinarians practicing on our board. Holly Nathan is from Watertown. She is a large animal and mixed animal practitioner. And lastly, Jake Witten, who is a large animal, mainly dairy practitioner from Alexandria. So that's our current board. Our mission with the Board of Animal Health is to safeguard the health of domestic animals in Minnesota. The current board structure, we've talked about our five board members who are appointed by the governor. They in turn appoint an executive director who is Dr. Bill Hartman, and my boss at this point. At the Board of Animal Health, we have 52 full-time employees. We're a fairly small agency. 32 of us are housed here in St. Paul in the office, and we have 20 people that are stationed around the state of Minnesota doing all of our field operations. Certainly our efforts are very cooperative. We work with the United States Department of Agriculture and Veterinary Services. We work with our Department of Agriculture, of course, and our Department of Natural Resources, Department of Health, and other agencies in the state. And our effort to eradicate tuberculosis currently is a good example of how these all fit together. We have tuberculosis in our domestic cattle herds. We work with our Department of Natural Resources counterparts because we have tuberculosis in white-tailed deer in northwest Minnesota. Also, tuberculosis is certainly a human health risk. Bovine tuberculosis will readily infect people, so we're always concerned about that, and we work with our folks from the Department of Health. Mr. Chairman and committee members, our proposed budget, the governor's budget for 2010 to 2011, general fund dollars for each year of the biennium is $5,156,000. For FY10, there is a dedicated receipt part of our budget. We're estimating that at about $710,000. What this is it's checkoff money that's collected for cattle that are sold in Minnesota. That program ends at the end of calendar year 9, so it's a 1 year of the biennium issue. The dedicated receipts for FY11, the $50,000 that's there, are actually receipts we collect from our farm survey producers. Those are the folks that raise deer and elk in the state, and they are there are fees assessed to those people each year that they participate. In federal funding, we project that each year we will bring in about $1.5 million. The federal budgets are being done now currently as we speak, and so that's all a little bit up in the air with the budget crisis. We're not sure if that money will come through as it has traditionally in the past, but we're projecting possibly $1.5 million. Let me talk a little bit about bovine tuberculosis specifically. For sure, that's our biggest effort at the Board of Animal Health this last year, and it has been for a couple of years now. Our budget, $2.5 million, is dedicated to tuberculosis, and that does include a $200,000 increase that's proposed by the governor's budget. That is to help pay annual payments to folks who took the herd buyout and agreed to depopulate their cattle herds in this last year. Dedicated receipts, again, we've talked about that. That's the checkoff dollars for cattle sold in Minnesota that ends in calendar 09. Federal funding, about $368,000 per year we have traditionally received from the federal government, and we hope that that will continue. The three main goals of our tuberculosis eradication program, we certainly intend to eradicate TB from Minnesota livestock, and currently there are no cattle that we're aware of that have bovine tuberculosis. Those herds have all been depopulated. We certainly want to maintain our split state status for tuberculosis. You do have a handout that has a map of that area. It's an area, a small area in northwest Minnesota, that's roughly between Thief River Falls and War Road. What that does, when we achieve split state status, it allowed cattle producers from all but that small area in northwest Minnesota to move cattle interstate with greater ease. It certainly helps with the testing requirements. And our ultimate goal, of course, is to achieve tuberculosis-free status once again for the entire state of Minnesota. Our bovine TB activities that are slated for this next year, we intend to test well over 1,000 cattle herds for tuberculosis. We also test some goat herds, bison herds, and farm survey herds. We actually have regulations in place, and we track all the animals that move in and out of our modified accredited zone, or that part of northwest Minnesota, and we have to account to USDA for every animal that moves out of that area. Enforcement, of course, is a part of this issue. If people don't know the rules, we make sure and educate them so they do. If they refuse, once they know what to do and they refuse to do that, we do get into enforcement activities. Luckily, the folks in Northwest Minnesota have been extremely cooperative, and our enforcement part has not been a big part of what we do. We do continue to make buyout herd payments to folks who agreed to depopulate their herds. That will go on until the state achieves free status. I'd like to talk a little bit about farm survey. That's an area that I work with very closely at the Board of Animal Health. We have a line item. We get $400,000 a year for our farm survey program. We also collect payments from our farm survey producers for inspection fees. That amounts to about $50,000. And with federal funding, we have received about $75,000 each year. We hope that that will continue. We've not gotten the final figures on that yet. With our farm survey folks, we've talked about this group to some of you before, but they're probably the most highly regulated group of livestock producers in the country. We require them to register all their animals and register the herds with the Board of Animal Health each year. We do have our folks on their farms, and we inspect them at least once a year, oftentimes more than that. We require that each animal that dies on these farms that's over 16 months of age be tested for chronic wasting disease. And that involves collecting brainstem and lymph nodes from the head of the animal and submitting those to our veterinary diagnostic laboratory. Also, deer and elk are susceptible to TB and brucellosis, so we have programs for that as well. Yoni's disease has been an extremely successful program with the Board of Animal Health over the last few years. There's a $100,000 reduction that's proposed for that program. So our annual line item would be reduced to $100,000. We usually receive about $350,000 from the federal government to support Yoni's activities. Because that program has been so successful and so many of our cattle producers, especially dairymen, have been trained in how to keep Yoni's disease out of their herds, we are in the process of shifting that responsibility to the private sector. So our folks will be doing far less Yoni's activities this coming year. Avian pneumovirus is another disease. This is a disease of turkeys. There's a $40,000 reduction proposed for that line item as well. At one point, about 60% of our turkey flocks were infected with avian pneumovirus. Currently, we're happy to report to this group that avian pneumovirus has almost been eradicated from turkeys in Minnesota. Huge process by the turkey industry, but very successful. And so with this $40,000 reduction, we will be able to accommodate that because there's less of the disease to deal with. As a summary of our budget reductions that have been proposed by the governor's budget, $100,000 came out of our Yoni's disease budget, $40,000 came out of our avian pneumovirus budget. From our general fund dollars, it's proposed that $322,000 would be taken out of our general funding for a total amount of reductions of $462,000. We, of course, have other diseases that we deal with on a daily basis. Avian influenza is one of them. We deal with rabies and, of course, the spinoff on what that does to the folks who are exposed to that disease. Pseudorabies in swine is still a disease that we're very concerned about, even though we don't have it in Minnesota. Our scrapie program for sheep producers, Phalarum typhoid for our poultry folks. Anthrax is always an issue that we deal with every spring, mainly in cattle, but it can affect horses as well. Equine infectious anemia is an ongoing program, brucellosis, and there are many others. We also deal with programs that don't deal directly with disease. Dead animal disposal is becoming a bigger issue all the time, emergency planning, our exhibitions, and so forth. We get involved with a lot of different parts of the livestock industry. We have two laboratories that we support. The University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, of course, is funded through the university. Fees, the Board of Animal Health does pay fees to that laboratory on a per-test basis. When pigs are tested for pseudorabies or horses are tested for EIA, in many cases we're able to cover those costs. And then there's our Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory in Wilmer, Minnesota, which is extremely important to the board. That laboratory is staffed by board personnel and personnel from the University of Minnesota that we actually pay salaries for. but a vital part of the turkey and chicken industry in Minnesota, that lab. I just mentioned very briefly that we're always vigilant and always ready to respond in case there's a foreign animal disease introduced into Minnesota. We will, of course, worry about foot and mouth disease, BSE, avian influenza, and other diseases that we do not have. This picture, this last picture I put up, is actually a bison that had decided not to stay in the chute that we had him in. There are a couple of bison herds in northwest Minnesota that we have to test for TB each year. And sometimes these animals don't behave exactly as we would like them to. This guy really was supposed to be down in the chute and not up above it. Luckily, nobody was injured in this case, and we were able to get that herd tested. But things don't always go according to plan. Mr. Chairman, that is my report.
All right, very good. Any questions, members, for the Board of Animal Health? We do appreciate the report. Obviously, last year was a big year where we, as you pointed out, put a lot of dollars in for the herd buyout and other things, and we're kind of settled back now into a more normal zone there, whatever normal is for TB. But and we'll keep an eye on it. Obviously, members, if we need to put money in at a second year of the biennium or something we're missing, we can certainly make those adjustments. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Anderson, are there TB-positive farms across the border into Canada that we know of, either in cattle, or is there TB-positive white-tailed deer or anything like that across the border in Canada that we are aware of?
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, at this particular point in time, I'm not aware of any positive herds. There have been positive TB herds in Canada, both in elk and in cattle, but I'm not aware of any that are near there or any that at this current time.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Otherwise, thank you very much. It was a good presentation, and we're going to move on to dairy and food inspection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Page 35 of the budget book, apparently. For those who want to follow along. No. And he should have a spreadsheet. I don't know which one it is here, but... there are spreadsheets in your folder. Dairy and food inspection is one of them. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed in any way you see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. Heidi Kassenberg, and I'm the Division Director for the Dairy and Food Inspection Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Today I'm going to talk about the programs that are within our division. You've probably seen this part of the mission statement before. As the primary food safety agency in Minnesota, our division is tasked with really the first part of our mission statement at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and that is ensuring the integrity of the food supply. And this is important not only for the consumer, but also to maintain consumer confidence in the food supply, which is very important for the facilities that we regulate. Our structure is defined in this slide. We have food inspection, dairy inspection, meat, egg, and poultry, and then also feed. So we have really regulatory authority for from the farm all the way almost to the table. This is our budget for proposed budget. You can see roughly half comes from general funds, and the other half is divided between federal grants and then also dedicated funding. So I mentioned that we have regulatory authority from farm to table, and I just wanted to define kind of some of where the roles and responsibilities lie within different agencies. You heard from the Board of Animal Health earlier. They have primarily farm-related issues with live animals. We have some of those within our areas of dairy farms. Then we also regulate food processors, distributors, and then we go up to the retail level, the grocery store and convenience store. And it's really at the plate is where we divide between our agency and Minnesota Department of Health. And so they do restaurants. And so that's a little bit of a, can be a confusing situation. But if you think about it, it's the plate. We do inspections, everything for that up to that point. So I mentioned, you know, with the budget, the dollars that we receive from the general fund and federal funding and then within the dedicated funding. And I can talk about what we do for a long time, but what actually illustrates it better is our DVD that we put together that describes what our inspectors do out in the field, and that's what I'm going to show you now.
When the refrigerator and cupboards are bare, we head to the grocery store. But the story of food safety doesn't start or even end there. It's the job of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, or MDA, to make sure you're eating or drinking a safe product. MDA is the enforcer of state laws and regulations related to food production, processing, and sale. MDA also conducts inspections for the Federal Food and Drug Administration using state authorities. It's MDA's Dairy and Food Inspection Division that oversees inspections from everything from dairy farms and food processing plants to grocery stores and convenience stores.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bigger with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm a food inspector, and today we're inspecting Franklin Street Bakery. For bakeries, it ultimately will get cooked, so but you want to, along the way, make sure you're not adding anything to the product that you don't intend to be in it. Usually flour will have things like flour beetles. Rodents are also attracted to bakeries sometimes, depending on the product, so those things you want to look for. But ultimately, handling of the product once it's cooked and making sure that employee handling of the product throughout the process is not adding anything to the bread that wasn't intended to be in it. Serving, hand washing.
Inspectors not only look at worker hygiene, they make sure proper safety measures are taken. Hairnets are worn and jewelry is not.
Coolers have a thermometer usually. And since it's a refrigerator, we like to see it below 40.
Armed with a thermometer, inspectors also make sure ingredients going into the final product are kept cool in order to minimize spoilage and unsafe bacteria. Temperature readings are taken and product date expiration dates are noted.
We can look at the egg date.
Inspection rules and regulations have changed over the years in an effort to ensure the safety of our food supply. And one key area that's become more important than ever is addressing food allergens.
So this product has nuts on it, and it's being stored underneath all the other products so that if a nut were to fall off, it wouldn't fall onto another product.
MDA staff also monitor and provide guidance on food labeling, making sure all potential allergens are declared right on the package. Again, from top to bottom, MDA's food inspectors are trying to ensure all food and beverages produced in Minnesota are the safest possible.
The inspection process just makes sure that the operators are doing what they're supposed to. So it's a very important process, but the most important process is having knowledgeable employees and knowledgeable operators.
My name is Sarah Meldrin. I'm a dairy inspector with the Minnesota Department of Ag. And today we are at a dairy farm inspecting the milkroom, parlor, and surrounding facilities.
Every 6 months, MDA employees inspect each dairy farm in the state of Minnesota.
Dairy inspection is an important part of food safety because this is where it all begins as far as milk. Milk is produced here, the animals are fed here, so it all starts here on the farm.
From floor to ceiling, inspectors examine every part of the facility and milking process to make sure the end result is a safe product.
The milk house is typically my first step when I come and do an inspection. It's where the milk tank is and a majority of the equipment. So I start here by filling out my inspection report and then typically like to look into the milk tank.
When the cows are milked, that milk gets pumped into this tank. It's essential as the milk sits there. It's safe from contamination and held at a proper temperature until it can be pumped into a truck and shipped off to be bottled or turned into another dairy product.
When I'm also looking in the tank, I'm also looking for a proper cover on the manhole, making sure that the milk in the tank is properly protected. There's no openings into this tank, any openings or caps.
After other equipment in the milk house is checked, inspectors follow the milk backwards through the system to where it comes from the cow.
When I come into the parlor, I'm looking for overall cleanliness of the parlor, walls, ceilings, doors, windows, and then proceed to the most important part, which is the melting equipment.
Inspectors make sure all of the equipment is properly sanitized and constructed of appropriate materials, making sure nothing harmful could come into contact with the milk.
This particular farm also has milk meters that weigh each individual cow's milk. I'm going to check and make sure those are properly cleaning, as these are.
Proper sanitation is key to food safety and important to producing quality milk. That's why sanitation, construction, and cleanliness of the equipment in a dairy barn are issues always at the forefront of the minds of MDA's inspectors. No areas are left unchecked.
I'm also observing any antibiotics or other items that the farm may have, making sure they have a prescription label on there from their veterinarian, which these do.
When an animal is sick, it is important to get the animal the proper treatment. Sometimes this means giving an animal antibiotics to help cure an infection. While the animal is on antibiotics, the milk from that animal is kept separate from the rest of the milk and not allowed to enter the human food system. Part of the milk inspector's job is to see that the medicines have proper labels instructing the dairy farmer how many days to keep the animal's milk out of the food supply. After going through the milking parlor, inspectors check other rooms in the milking facility, including break rooms, offices, and utility rooms.
In this room, I would look at where the water supply is coming from, where it's going to, making sure the water is properly protected in all ways. We have a well coming in over here. I'm looking, following. I follow all the water pipes to make sure water is properly protected, not only for the cows to drink, but also for equipment cleaning.
Inspectors also look outside the milking facility, checking the source of the water and the source of the milk, the cows.
I'm looking for cow comfort, cleanliness, cow health, making sure that they're properly cared for, properly bedded, alleys are scraped clean.
MDA employees follow a thorough inspection process, whether 260 cows are being milked, like here, or 60 at this farm.
There's no difference between size of farm. A larger farm may have more equipment, more things to look at, but basically they're all under the same rules and regulations, and I look for the same things.
When finished, the inspector reviews a completed inspection form with the farmer, noting any violations or changes that could or need to be made.
Overall, dairy farmers are interested in producing the best quality milk they can, so I'm interested in working with them, kind of a partnership to make sure that they're is a safe supply of milk.
After the milk leaves the farm, it heads off to be processed or bottled.
My name is Dana Martin, dairy inspector with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I'm here at the Kemp Milk Plant today to do a time inspection.
Just like at the farm, sanitation and construction of equipment at a milk bottling plant is very important. Inspectors begin where bottles and other ingredients come into the plant and follow the milk through the process.
These bottles are going to be finished products, and I want to make sure that they're handled correctly and there's no problem with any contamination. We're going to go right from here to a filling machine and then they'll be closed.
The most important part of a milk bottling or processing plant is the milk pasteurizer. Pasteurization is the process of heating milk at set temperature for a specific time period to kill off any bacteria or organisms.
Milk pasteurization is important for a number of reasons, and the first issue is public health. And consuming raw milk, in some cases, can be directly tied to illness.
In a pasteurizer, milk passes over a heat exchanger and brought up to the proper temperature and held there for a period of time to kill any harmful organisms. The temperature needs to be maintained for the entire time period for the pasteurization process to be effective. These heat and time requirements are very specific. These standards are set by scientists and federal food safety agencies. After the allotted time, the temperature is again checked to make sure the milk was kept at the proper temperature throughout the process. If too low, the milk is pumped back to start the process over. If everything checks out okay, the milk is cooled and sent to storage tanks to be used or bottled. MDA inspectors not only visually check to make sure all equipment is working properly, but they also do testing to verify the accuracy of the plant's equipment and how it's used when they aren't there. The inspector looks through data from the plant to verify that what the plant workers say they're doing is what actually goes on.
A significant part of our inspection process is verifying the accuracy of the equipment that's involved in pasteurization. and this includes thermometers, includes sensors for raw and pasteurized sides of the heat exchanger. It includes timing for the pasteurizing system to make sure the holding time is correct. So we'll spend a significant amount of that inspection time doing just that and only that, so that we can take our time, make sure we do a thorough job.
After testing, NDA inspectors place a seal on all of the devices to prevent any tampering. The inspection process continues into the bottling room where inspectors monitor sealing machines.
Looking for a proper seal, and I'm looking for general machine cleanliness. There shouldn't be any milk splash or grease or anything that doesn't really belong in there. And once we get to the end of the line there, I'll inspect the inspection seal.
Again, from beginning to end, inspectors follow the dairy products from raw goods to finished food.
The Department of Ag program has been released to this grade A class, so it's vital. And there's a lot of milk that comes through here. We follow that milk from farm to the silo to up the door and the cooler. And I think that it's very important that there's local inspection and that we do a nice job here. It's a reflection of what they try to do at the plant. We try to help out wherever we can with their quality products.
Milk is also made into quality products like ice cream. Once again, sanitation and construction of equipment are key.
This was going to be raw product, but the cleanliness is a big issue here because of the nature of the equipment. This is a tough area to clean.
Just like at the milk bottling plant, pasteurization is critical in an ice cream facility. Inspectors take a great deal of time to assure pasteurization standards are met and maintained when they aren't there. Therefore, it's up to the plant to provide evidence that procedures are followed correctly. Through each step of the inspection, a representative of the plant accompanies the NDA inspector.
Each inspection is a joint inspection with either the quality manager or the plant manager. And as we discover something that needs correction, it's either corrected during the inspection or it's listed on a report, and then there's a follow-up. And on the subsequent inspection, we'll check off and make sure stuff is completed.
All of the rules and regulations concerning dairy products are spelled out in a federal document called the Pasteurized Milk Ordinance, or PMO. The state of Minnesota adopts the PMO as its own rule. This document sets guidelines for inspections and works as general operating procedures for dairy farms and processors. Milk produced to the standards set by the Pasteurized Milk Ordinance can be sold anywhere in the United States. Knowledge is key at the place where most of us come into contact with food, the grocery store.
I'm Catherine Freemeyer, a food inspector with the Dairy and Food Inspection Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Today we're inspecting a grocery store, and we are going through the deli, bakery, fresh meat, and general grocery areas.
Food inspectors look at their job in two ways, as enforcer of rules and regulations, and as educators.
How it says barley flour, it's a huge teaching opportunity to be able to help people understand the interaction between the rules that we're coming to enforce and to know the reasoning behind them so that they have a better way to make their own decisions on a day-to-day basis when we're not here.
One of the most diverse areas of food inspection is the grocery store. Not only are there food storage issues, but some of the items we purchase at the store are made right on site.
We look for the things that are the most potentially hazardous, which would be a ready-to-eat, hot or cold held food, and then working down through some of the room temperature stuff where it's still ready to eat, and then some of the stuff that's going to be further processed or that's not potentially hazardous, like the general grocery areas where it's just dry storage holding issues.
Correct temperatures are critical to food safety.
Have any of these salads been out recently?
Inspectors make it a point to talk with employees to make sure they are aware of proper procedures and regulations.
Is this the sanitizer that you use, or do you use any cleaning in between?
Would you clean them between, but I want them sanitized after every time.
After each area is thoroughly checked, it's time to turn to the report. Whether they're at a grocery store, bakery, or food processing plant, each inspector completes a written report outlining observations and any situations that need to be remedied.
We have two parts to the report. The first part is, it's kind of like a cover sheet. The top half is considered foodborne illness risk factors and public health interventions. These are all things that have been directly linked to various foodborne illness outbreaks.
That would include employee hygiene, such as hand washing, approved source of their foods, a lot of the temperature issues that we look for, whether it's cooling, cooking, hot holding, cold holding.
The bottom half of the report outlines good retail practices. While still important for running a food facility, these practices are a bit less critical. These issues include clean floors, appropriate plumbing, and food labeling. The second half of the report includes written comments and any issues that need to be taken care of to bring a facility into compliance.
What we're looking for is pretty much people who have lots of food handling.
The final component of any inspection involves a meeting between the inspector and members of the business management team. They go over the report and discuss any changes that could or need to be made. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture's food inspection program is key to food safety. The department works closely with processors and retailers to improve and maintain their procedures. It truly is a partnership.
Sometimes there's compromises, give and take between the two of us as far as what needs to be done, what should be done, what has to be done. But in reality, the whole thing, it's a partnership that helps us produce a better, safer product.
I view the inspection process very helpful. They really come in and look at what we're doing, offer suggestions for things that maybe we're not doing properly. They really come in and just look at what we're doing and make sure that we're doing a good job. It's important for us to do a good job, and they really just offer help.
The fact that I've worked in like five or six states, and Minnesota tends to be, I would say, more stricter, but they're just ahead of the game, I guess, and I've learned that. And I think they would do a good job as far as they come and present the problem to us, and then they help us educate us how to get rid of the problem.
I do rely pretty heavily on whether it's the expertise of Dana or somebody else at the department to make sure that our public health controls are doing what they're supposed to be doing on a daily basis.
We've always gotten along fine with them, and it's one of those things where it's kind of an everyday thing. You kind of have to work at keeping things clean and keeping things up to date, and all those things kind of go hand in hand with the inspections.
It's always, how can we get this done, and acknowledging that it all can't happen overnight, and working together with us and maybe meeting halfway until we can do the final solution.
The relationship, I think, is a good one. I think we understand that our regulatory is there to ensure food safety, and that they're not there to be our adversary. They're there to help us make sure that we produce wholesome food for the public, and they help us find things that maybe we wouldn't look at ourselves.
That partnership also includes other government agencies. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture investigates reports of food contamination, working together with state and local health officials to determine the cause of outbreaks of foodborne illnesses. NDA employees work hard each day to ensure your family's food is safe to eat. But why is it important for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to take on this duty?
When you buy your food at a grocery store, the typical consumer doesn't know exactly where it came from. They don't know all the people that were involved in making that product. And so it's important for somebody like the Department of Agriculture to be involved in that process and overseeing what's going on in the facilities to make sure that the product is a safe product for the consumer and it is what they think they're buying.
With the authority to enforce state laws and regulations, the department is also able to provide something no one else can, a consistent inspection system across all of Minnesota. By unifying the process, the MDA avoids a patchwork of agencies trying to provide inspections and safeguards to the state's food supply. Overlap or possibility of gaps in the food safety system are minimized. This also results in efficient use of public resources. So at the end of the day, there's just one goal: to protect your food from farm to table. And it's all thanks to a group of dedicated employees from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
First of all, a comment. I do like the department doing the division presentations here. They're good, but can you tell me, maybe you or Ms. Cheney, I don't know if she's here anymore, yeah, there she is, how these are used? do they go to health classes at our high schools? Are they in our colleges? This is a way to show kids and up-and-comers. I know Rep. Otremba sits on the Ag Educators group. Are we utilizing these to let people know what we do and maybe get them interested in a career here and other things? What's a tape like that use or a DVD use?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. That's, all of those venues, all of those opportunities are things that we're looking at. We originally wanted to tell the public our message of what we do, but we realized that this is a great educational tool. This video is on our website. We also have a YouTube channel for people that we can direct them to as well. And for those that don't have that capacity, we have it on DVD and we can get that to you. So we're also using it to recruit at some of our HR. Human resources are using it to recruit employees to our department.
I think maybe there's an opportunity for some more interface, particularly at our high school level, I think, to get people interested, whether it's an ag class or a health class, or I think this is interesting stuff that would be a real benefit to the teachers, too. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on the pages that were handed out. Three questions. First, on page one, you've got an increase on other operating costs of $750,000 for 2009 compared to 2008. I'm wondering what that is for. I didn't hear you cover that. If you did, I apologize. There's also then a couple lines below that. State meat inspection is being cut by over the 2 years by almost $400,000, almost a 50% cut. And then on page number nine, we've got, again, an operating cost of about $500,000 each of the next 2 years increase over what it was. If you could briefly describe what those changes are, I'd appreciate it.
Well, the first page, the operating costs, again, went from, in 08, from $6,000 to $773,000, and now you're backing off to $220,000 and $107,000. So there's been a real variability in that. Can you explain what that was?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've had some hiring difficulties. We've had a lot of turnover in our staff. We have quite a number of staff that are retiring, and it can take a considerable time to replace those. We've had, particularly this year, we've had quite a difficulty hiring in the Brainerd area and also within the metro area. We've had several turn downs for those positions, and so then that results in salary savings. So that changes the 09 figure, the $300,000. The increase in $500,000, I believe, is due to, is that just the general fund or is that overall?
Well, again, we're looking at the other operating costs, not necessarily the full-time labor costs. There's a line item. I don't know if you have the spreadsheet that we have in front of you. If you don't, maybe Ms. Cheney has it. But on page one, line 2MO, other operating costs, and there's been a big bounce up and down in those. So it's not salaries unless you're having to hire consultants or someone else to fill in those holes, but I don't think that's it.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative, that's something I'm going to have to research. I'm not clear on that, so I'll have to get back to you.
You can get back to us on that. And then the meat inspectors, you're saying there's just been difficulty. You've either not had a full complement or that's reflected there?
Mr. Chair, actually that's due to accounting changes. The budget for meat inspection is going to be the same, but it has to do with changes in our accounting system. We're trying to do it a different way and keeping better track of that, and so that's the reason for those changes there. But I assure you that those will be very similar as far as meat inspection numbers.
Dean, another one, Representative Foster.
Yeah, the last one is on page 9 where we've got that other operating cost jumping by $500,000 for 09 and 010 and then disappearing. I guess it's also in 011. So I'm just wondering where that, what program that is or where that's coming from, why we had the big spike.
Under meat inspection, again, we went from 2,000 and other to 506, and that's steady then for the next 2 years. And I don't know what other operating costs are there for $500,000.
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, that's something I'll have to get back
okay.
to you on that.
Let us know. I mean, overall, you have no change items in dairy and food, I don't think, right? Other than there's some fee adjustments that we see on page 21 in the book. But beyond that, your dairy, your food handlers, dairy facilities, other fees are being adjusted, but that's the only major change items in your division?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct.
All right. Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some questions about the dairy farmers and the fact that they're having a really hard time and the fees are going up so high. Is it a possibility that we can kind of wait for a while? Because if this is happening, they may have some concerns.
Dr. Katzenberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative, perhaps I just want to give a little bit of background about the inspection fees, the reinspection. This isn't charged every time we go out there. It's only if there's a serious violation that needs to be corrected, and then it needs to be checked on to make sure that it's done. And so that's really to ensure the timely correction of these violations.
So the only time there's a fee is it's a reinspection fee. You're out there routinely every 6 months?
Right.
And there's no fee for that?
That is paid by the plant itself.
Okay.
But the reason for the reinspection fees are really to cover the cost of time and travel by the inspector, but then oftentimes the supervisor gets involved too, and the compliance officer. We currently get $45 for dairy inspection fees, but that doesn't really cover the costs of going back out there. So then it's supplemented those general funds. So I guess the money needs to come somewhere, and it's up to you whether it needs to be coming from the dairy farmer themselves or the general fund.
So again, all your dairy fees are billed to the plant that's picking up the milk. Are the reinspection fees billed there too?
So that goes to the dairy farmer.
That goes to the farmer, Representative Tremba.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've been a dairy farmer for a long time, and sometimes it's just a little thing, and they still have to come back. And so then that fee, even if it was something that wasn't really major, it was something minor, and they still have to come back, that's still $100. And when you're having, you know, $9 milk, that's we're not making.
Dr. Katzenberg?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the only time they go back is for a serious public health violation. If there's a serious sanitation issues or some major malfunctioning of equipment.
And Representative Trump.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the dollars that you need, but I also understand that the dairy farmers right now are having a hard time. Maybe we could delay it for a little while until they get on their feet, because they are having a really hard time.
Okay. Well, that's something certainly we'll take into consideration as we write the bill the next few weeks here as a committee. Any other questions? Otherwise, we have one more division to get through quick for today. Thank you. Here comes our lab guys with peanut butter samples, right? Oh. What page are we on now? 38. Page 38. And you do have a spreadsheet for this also. Laboratory services. All right, got about 10 minutes till the end of time. Lucky you, you don't run out.
All right.
Prolong you too long.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I'm Gary Horvath. I'm the lab director for the Department of Agriculture. I'll try to go through quickly what we do. We probably don't have a lot of time for questions, but if you want to just jump in at any time, I'll try to breeze through it. The mission basically is to provide analysis, impeccable leadership to the regulatory divisions that we serve, and ultimately to protect the public. Division structure, myself, director, I have one assistant director, Doug Bacher, and two section managers, and we have 50 FTEs and a couple seasonal people, which can vary from season to season, but that's generally what we run with. Getting to the budget, the general fund is $3.883 million. Of that, about $2.3 million is for rent. Dedicated funds, $2 million. Federal, we anticipate $2,400,000. That represents an increase that we recently received for over $700,000. We got money from the USDA Food Emergency Response Network. We were selected as one of four labs to have a regional training center and a unknown biological agent accessioning, and we're working with our Department of Health on a cooperative venture there. So that was a big feather in our cap, and we just got that. And you should have a policy note, I believe. Miscellaneous agency, that's basically we are the DNR's laboratory, and that's what that is. And that probably might be going up, but we're negotiating with them right now. Basically, we're structured around the new lab facility. We have a chemistry and a biological floor, two floors of the main analytical part, and the various sections that we serve are represented there. First off is ChemTox. We provide mostly agricultural input, feed, fertilizer, lime, everything that goes into the production of agriculture. Looking at nutritional, at the labeling, label claims, look at complaints, do a variety of tests to ensure that the farmer is getting what they purchased. Chemistry, toxicology section also does the primary food chemistry. We do dairy for compliance with the milk shippers, pasteurized milk ordinance. Compositional chemistry, verifying again that 2% is 2%. We deal with consumer complaints. We also do meat testing for compositional chemistry. We also do the USDA equivalent program that we support, and we do lab testing for that. And then food, we do a variety of food testing, mycotoxins, allergens, consumer complaints. The next slide, extraneous matter. We get called in to identify different rodent filth, feces from various animals, hair, you name it. These result from consumer complaints and to support the facility inspection, to try to identify what kind of critter is there and what they need to do to get visit. They also do the inorganic water monitoring program. This is in support of our pesticide and fertilizer management division, who takes water quality nutrient samples to help characterize the water that they're sampling for pesticides. We also, as part of our DNR agreement, it's got to be over 10 years now, 10 years with the DNR. They consolidated their hitting lab and their Carlos Avery lab a number of years ago. We took on that work and they closed those facilities. And we've had a good working relationship with them. We do all the lakes and streams survey, hatchery permit, incident response. And in the minerals, we're doing all the water leachate, that they do a lot of testing to figure out how to deal with mine tailings and that type of thing. So we work with them on design. They design their experiment, and we work with them on carrying those out. Moving on the chemistry floor, we have an environmental analysis section. Basically, we're the state FIFRA lab, which is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act. We support all the pesticide regulatory activities of the department, and that's basically broken up into the water monitoring unit. Basically, that is the started in 1985. We've been doing that. The 89 groundwater bill built that program up, and we've been doing it ever since. We're looking at environmental fate monitoring, looking to see what's going on. As part of that program, we also are a participant and receive some of the grant money you see. It's for the USDA Pesticide Database Program, which is the program that produces data to support registration and re-registration for the EPA, and it's looking at overall risk and looking at the risk cup when they're making regulatory decisions. So we do all the water, we did all the bottled water, and we're looking at groundwater with them. Moving on, the environmental or forensics unit. This is where we do all of the drift, misuse, illegal dumping, you know, human exposure, anything where pesticides end up where they're not supposed to, we get involved with that in that unit. We also do some limited pesticide formulations, mostly producer establishments at places that actually package or repackage. We also get involved if, you know, if there's a misapplication related to formulation. This unit also is part of the Food Emergency Response Network on the chemistry side, which is administered by the Food and Drug Administration. That is a program that we're one of seven cooperative agreement labs chosen by the FDA. As part of that, we're working on methodology and various food matrices for agents of chemical terrorism. They identify the matrix, and we have a list of compounds, and we get assigned various matrices, and we do the method development. The participation in this was very beneficial last year when we had the melamine. Because of the year before the food or the pet food issue, the FDA Fern looked at that, and we were part of developing those methods. So when that hit last year, we were in a great position to respond. And as a consequence, we found it in some cookies from Vietnam, which led to a nationwide recall. So it's really positioned us well to protect the citizens. Moving on, microbiology. Basically, we're performing analysis on food, meat, beverages, water. We work closely with the health department on outbreak situations, that type of thing. We're looking at high-risk foods or surveillance work that go to, you know, delicatessens, that type of thing where there's a high potential for cross-contamination, that type of thing. We work with the USDA programs. Again, we support the interstate milk shippers. This is in the micro side. And we're looking at well and source water at food production plants. Okay, on time. Sorry. peanut butter, as you mentioned, the Salmonella typhimurium, we work closely with health department, and we were the lab that identified the outbreak strain in peanut butter. And we also were one of two labs that isolated in an unopened container. And that, again, a lot of that work is built on the FERN and our participation and close working relationship with health, which the new building, by the way, for my first opportunity to testify in my new role. Just wanted to thank members. We're very pleased with the facility, and just I think it was a very good decision a number of years ago. Again, on the microbiology side, we are also one of seven labs chosen on the USDA side of FERN to work on biological agents, terrorism agents. We're looking at anthrax, we look at botulinum toxin, and a variety of other agents deemed as a high risk for terrorist use. We work on methodology. And again, we just were notified we received over $700,000 for the FERN Training Center and the triage area, the unknown affectioning area. So you should have a policy note on that. And then finally, is plant pathology seed analysis. We're looking at seed purity, germination. We're also looking at some sudden oak death for the plant pathology, and we get, you know, disease du jour comes along, and we end up having to respond. So we're looking at that area, and that's an area where, you know, we're investigating where we're going on that. So we'll be making some decisions, I think, in the coming year. So with that, we also have an operations section, which they don't do any of the fancy stuff, but they keep the lab functioning. They receive samples, ship samples around, purchase inventory. So that's kind of how we're structured. And with that, I guess I'll open it to questions.
I know there was a question here. We were looking at it under the on your spread, on your main sheet, under Environment Natural Resources. There's appropriation of 368 $300,000 a year, and then there's an unappropriation of $368,000 a year. What's that?
Mr. Chairman, that is the LCCMR money. That was a one-time purchase of an LC-MS-MS mass spectrometer to do water work.
That's correct.
I believe that it got put in there and they took it out for the next two, because that equipment has been purchased and we have it.
All right. Any other questions for the lab? All right. Thank you for coming in. Again, I think as our committee looks forward the next few weeks here, putting our budgets together, clearly it's important. Our dairy inspectors, our food inspectors, our lab services, I think, are some of those core functions that we need to be really careful with and make sure that we have the appropriate resources there. But we don't want you to waste any money.
No.
So beyond that, members, tomorrow is a AURI, among others, and they will have a food little experiment that we're participating in, so you don't want to miss that. And our former committee administrator will be here to run that, Kate Beyer, who's now Kate Parrish. All right? Very good. We are dismissed.